Good evening, everybody. It is Wednesday night. It's just after 7 o'clock. We're on California time out here, so we get to do, like, whatever.
Yay.
I knew you'd like that one, Emily. But in spite of all of that, we are working our way through Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. And somehow, by some miracle, by some portal of chance and unsuspected luck, in my opinion, we have made it to chapter 9. How we got here, others will have to tell us at another time. But all I know is I opened the book, and that's where we seem to be. So
I think the first paragraph might explain what happened.
Thank you. And so if you would be so kind, M.A., as to start us off on Chapter 9, and just tell us, try to help locate us.
Okay. Chapter 9, The Art and Science of Invocation. All macro-dimensional invocation is focused on the activation of corresponding resonators between chambers until they vibrate in sympathetic unison. We also have the ability as a being to self-invoke, to expand our morphology into a space where we are not. I think I was trying to do that right before I came here.
Yes, you were. So apparently, if we read this chapter, we'll understand that header. So all we need to do is get through the chapter, and it appears that you'll understand everything, or just about everything, and that's probably a good thing. All right,
let's go for it.
Did you read the chapter?
Well, a long time ago.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
But actually, this is, you read it, and then you start practicing. So this is what I've been doing for the last, you know, since this book came out, when whatever year that this book was written. I mean, this stuff doesn't go away.
Well,
1986.
We're happy to hear that MA's been practicing for the last 30 years.
Right.
And she's declaring that she's finally got it right. So we're in luck tonight. Okay. Now I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on the header because it's worth it to break that apart a little bit and to give us some context as we go through this particular river of something or another. So all macro-dimensional invocation. We have a word there called invocation, is focused on the activation of corresponding resonators between chambers until they vibrate in sympathetic unison. Okay, this is not brand new information. It's stuff that we've talked about in the last few chapters. And this idea of the vibratory sensation. As we get into further and further into these spaces and we get into the Life in the Labyrinth, and I warned you of this many weeks ago when we started this, is that we become, our feet aren't as rooted on the earth as they were. And as we head into more of the labyrinthine voyaging, the bardo spaces that are indicated here, it'll be less easy to get our footing. Except this idea of vibratory sensation. Each of us have a signature called the vibratory sensation, and that's what you hold on to. And as the depth and the amount of energy builds, that becomes a way, that becomes a form of compass for us, is sensing that vibratory sensation, understanding it when you get into the, that's why I say when we get into the particular spaces that we're talking about here, mark that space. When you know what it's like, mark that space and say, that's what it is. Then do an inventory of your voyaging body, that morphology that you came in with, and what is it that I want to mark about it? And the key one for me is all this idea of this vibratory sensation. And it is a compass for me. And it's a fascinating compass. And we'll move into it a little bit in the chapter as we go through it. And we're going to talk a little bit about the idea of invocation. I'm not going to let you off the hook on this chapter. You're going to actually need to respond. And those who are online are going to need to respond by actually writing something into the log, because I post the logs and they'll eventually get up there. Now, the first couple of paragraphs, a lot of the bulk of this chapter, the author is telling us just like where we are in relationship to words like magic, invocation, occlusion, because from a temporal point of view, we are stuck in magic and not magic. And anything that is not, that doesn't spring from just the natural logical world must be magic, right?
Exactly.
That's what we hear around us all the time. If you do that, it must be magic. The answer to that is no. And what we're doing, and we have 8 chapters behind us and gathering data, we know that it's not magic. We know that it's cleansing our eyelids in such a way that we are seeing into, we say it, seeing into the macro dimensions. Even that is an assumption, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
All we're doing is we're seeing what's right there anyway. We're seeing what's there. And we've all been there. The point is, and all I'm trying to do, is that E.J. Gold in this book, Life in the Labyrinth, is giving us an excellent manner. It's a how-to manual. The how-to manual. But we have to use it. This is not a scholarly work as such, even though it actually is, and that's a different conversation. But point is that we have something here we can use in which to do set markers. Now I want to make a point about last week's chapter 8. Chapter 8 was lightning handlers always crackle. And we taught, it was a fascinating chapter, and there's like 11 responses on the website, wingsofchaos.com, under Life in the Labyrinth. There's a very nice conversation that goes on there. And what I wanted to say is that there's this whole concept of lightning crackles, lightning handlers always crackle, is that there's a, when the more vibratory sensation comes in, one of two things and only two things will happen to the extent of the force of that objective love or the grace that comes flowing through you, one of two things happen. You'll leave the space. If your morphology isn't pliable enough to allow it, you will leave the space. One way or another, you won't be there. You'll physically leave it, you'll fall asleep, you'll start an argument, you'll change topics, you'll do something, but you'll leave that chamber where the amount of energy is more than your morphology can handle. So part of it, now, if your morphology can handle it, what happens?
You stay.
And if your challenge and your morphology can't handle it, you upscale, and then you are able to handle more. So, lightning handlers always crackle is a hint that when that's occurring, there's a chance for you to do something different, and it's expanded upon in this chapter in the art and science of invocation. So jumping ahead a little bit, in its primary meaning, magic signifies ritual, not necessarily occultist or religious, should include all those psycho-emotional forms that can be utilized by a voyager to make transition into the macro dimensions. Now, let me ask you right now, you're at home or you're listening to this at a later time. What are the macro-dimensional, what are these instruments and forms that you've placed around you right now to create a macro-dimensional effect? I'll tell you what mine are, I have a microphone. There's a camera in front of me. I decided to put this phone here, and it has a microphone. I have a colleague sitting next to me. There's this cup of tea here. There's a glass case, a book. Now the instruments of this macro-dimensional moment are set. Right?
Right.
Now that they're set and I sit here, guess what? Guess what happens to me? What happens to me is a little door opens and I'm able to go through it. And because I'm able to go through that door, I can begin to understand some of what is offered to us in this writing that's before us. What are the macro-dimensional devices that are around you right now? Look at your desk, or some of you are on the phone, and there's possibly a particular stance that you're taking, or there's your cup of coffee, or, okay, a couple of you have an adult beverage there, and maybe a writing instrument. But certainly you have a computer and a monitor in front of you and maybe a mouse. Those are the elements that you've chosen for this event. Some people will maybe put a live flower there, freshly cut flower. Maybe there's a scent in the air that you always choose for this particular 1 hour on Wednesday night. It doesn't have to be so exotic that it's unreachable. It's what you do naturally to begin the process, to begin opening that door. Make sense?
Yes, it does. I would put a picture there, maybe or a representational item of some sort.
An item that represents what?
Well, that might be a... little amulet of Gorbag's garden.
It might be an amulet that reminds you of the space. And you look at the thing, and you look at it, and then you go, oh, that's why I put that there. Now I remember, because what you're doing is you're realigning with those elements, those instruments, your vibratory sensation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says in the first paragraph of this reading, right? And it says, uses the words invocation. I looked up the definition of invocation. Oxford English Dictionary. It's not a great definition, but the action or act of invoking or calling upon God or a deity in prayer or attestation. Attestation means that I'm determined to be there. I'm affirming it, that I am there in that space, and I'm willing to be in that space. It's supplication, and we call that the act of surrender. The act of surrender is an intentional act, right? And as we get further along in these modalities, surrender is critical here. The ecclesiastical form and definition then of invocation, a form of invocatory prayer as part of a public religious service, also the name or appellation used in invoking a divinity. So these, we understand this, you know, the petitions addressed to each person of the Godhead or to the Trinity, which form the opening part of an Anglican or Roman Catholic litanies, and for instance, I'll tell you one that works for me is like, and we talked about the clear light prayer. Now I am experiencing the clear light of objective reality. So those words are like the opening, really what it is, and all the prayer when we go to church and we see that, it's all these guys are doing. They're creating invocational moments that then the members can move through if they are so desirous of doing that. We have the same thing in front of us here.
You shared an invocation. I'd like to also share an invocation that
Please.
I use. I wish to invoke the presence of my presence into the present.
So that becomes a it's like a power phrase for MA.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee that if she's in the heat of massive upset and confusion, which I have seen her in, very painful state, if one moment she could remember that phrase, it would go boom, because she wouldn't be stopping that reactive machine sensation. You wouldn't be doing that. What you'd be doing is stepping into someplace else, wouldn't you?
Well, I would be allowing the crackling to go on, going on with a as a light handler.
As a light, she would become a light handler rather than a human
runner
biological machine in reactivity. And we all have been there. Sometimes magic is used to mean evocation, the drawing up of a lower dimensional voyager. We're not, that's not what we're talking about here. I'm skipping around a lot, but that's okay. Or it's invocation in which we upscale from a lower dimension, dimensional morphology into a macro dimensional morphology, and this morphology then means our shape. And by shape here, I don't mean this envelope. The, you know, yours looks different than mine,
mm-hmm.
but I mean it's like the electrical shape that you bring to it. And I don't know if Simon Templar is on, but if he is, he could tell us a little bit about what Don Juan says about the luminous egg and that shape that comes when you're in that very special place. Then they use very specific ritualistic tools, including assisting factors, to get them into some very unusual spaces. So the culturally charged words magic and invocation can be translated into a more technical language, the sense of which was partly conveyed in the chapter on time and space before. That we remember that one. Stripped of its trappings of pseudo-spiritual taboo, invocation can be said to be based on an alteration of our temporal and temporary dimensional morphologies. Okay, so can we give some examples? I don't know if anybody's saying anything online. Can you give me an example of how you go about the alteration of your temporal and temporary dimensional morphology? This is, people need to speak up at this point. How do you go about specifically modifying your temporal and dimensional morphology? There is a way you do it. I'm thinking of somebody who... temporary, dimensional. There is a method you use. Be simple, try not to be complex. Simple, not complex. I won't say anything for a couple of minutes till others speak up. Is anybody saying anything? So, Hawk Lady says, so a method of temporal macrodimensional changes for her is I bring the attention onto the machine. Okay. I stay with it until I am there with it. And that's what we're talking about with you,
mm-hmm.
is that you go there. Because that act, and we learned this in HBM, the act of placing your attention on the machine is merely the act, well, I say merely, the act of awakening the machine. And that opens the door to the beginning of all their stuff. That's like a given. All right? If anybody's doing readings out there, how do you begin your reading? Molly, write it down, type it in. How do you begin a reading? What are some, there's three specific things you do. And then you, right? Yeah, but for others. Okay, sometimes these things are, as I call it, they're too simple for the human mind. Okay? Answer, get out of the human mind. So Molly's writing something, and she's saying, I enter the space, which for her happens to be a very technical thing. And then she says she lights a candle, lights incense, and rings a bell. So those are like the traditional things. Those are simple things called an alteration of our temporal and temporary dimensional morphology. Okay? Invocation in its esoteric sense refers to the technique that enables one to access or activate a broad category of phenomena indicating the activation of elements or laws of the macro dimensions. So what that means is that once we do some of these things, we can begin to see elements of it around us, right? We can see that the invocation has started.
Space changes?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about, is this, that you start to become very aware of the change of vibratory sensation. And when that occurs and it says the broad category of phenomena changes, and that we talked about extensively last week in light, the temperature in the room. Some people report that they smell something different, like a high tone of a flower.
Mm.
The light takes on. There was a full eclipse of the sun on Sunday. I was in Reno. And that was interesting in itself. So during the moment of that full eclipse, the quality of light was what I would call the quality of light that I sense in these macro-dimensional spaces. It was clear but soft. There's a softness to the light. There wasn't a harshness to it.
Diffused. It was kind of diffused.
There was more of a diffusion,
yeah,
of it. Virtually any chamber can become accessible by using the technique of morphological shape-shifting corresponding to the topological configuration of one or another macro-dimensional inhabitant. Do we understand this? An assumption can be defined as taking upon oneself a characteristic of that macro-dimensional character. Okay.
Well, do we call morphological shape-shifting those things that happen, the subtle light? Do we call that?
No, those are the qualities in the space that you notice. The macro-dimensional shape-shifting is us that changes. We morph into a different shape. You actually become a different shape at that time. Is Simon online? Okay. You literally become a different shape. You are a different shape of something. And those that have eyes can see it. And people will transform. I know somebody that in a certain way during regular moments, kind of like a little bit clumsy, and sometimes doesn't do the world real well. But in other moments, which is in the space, absolute clarity, scary clarity, different shape has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
The shape occurred inside, though, not the outside shape that changed. And then you have what I call a brilliant individual, quite frankly. I'll tell a little bit of a story. Have you ever heard of the Tibetan, the Oracle of Tibet?
I have heard of it.
Have you heard of the Oracle of Tibet?
Uh-huh.
Okay. The Oracle of Tibet, and this, I don't know, it's forever, okay? Tibet as a spiritual nation has been such for about 1,000 years, if my memory is correct. And the head of the state, as you know, is the Dalai Lama. And the head administration of the state of Tibet has employed an oracle.
I met the oracle. I forgot that I met the oracle.
Yes. There's one oracle at a time. Now, the oracle is a particular individual that is called forth to be in that role. In the last oracle died in sometime in the mid-80s. The present oracle, it took 3 years for him to come forth. And the person that came forth, that person thought he was the most unlikely person, but there was a selection of this person. Now, what happens is the oracle understands precisely. Now we're talking about using the word in a truly scientific manner, precisely how to get into the space, into the oracular space that he is charged with being in. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He understands exactly how to go there. Once the oracle is in that space, that person loses total control of their body. It's dramatic to watch. It's like the shape, it's the amount of chi that is moving through that is just staggering. And in that oracular space then communicates with certain things to two witnesses that are scribes, and they're recording what he says as he's going through this space. That's their duty. And it looks anything but pleasant. It looks horribly difficult. Because what you're saying is, oh, you mean you need me to hold on to these two power lines for about a half hour here and see if I can reconnect the phone lines? Okay. Yeah, I'll do that. No problem. Clump, and then you become something utterly different for, I don't know, 10, 20 minutes. I don't know, maybe it's longer. I don't know the length of time, but it looks massively interesting. I mean, staggering, the amount of energy that goes through this individual. Now, think of this for a moment. He's sitting there watching the latest baseball game or something. He gets a call from the Dalai Lama and he says, I need you to go into that space. What would I say? Oh, I think you have the wrong number. Click. He doesn't have a choice, does he? Because he's taken on that obligation. And that's a teeny, teeny bit of what we mean by operating in the work here. We are charged, and the people that are here, how many people are here on that show? So there are 14, Lupe's on the phone, there's four of us here in this space. It's like 20 people altogether, okay? We have a duty, in a sense, to allow, and this we talked about last week, to allow this grace to flow through us in as pure a manner as possible, because we're taking a stand at that moment. We're taking a stand for that part of the world rather than the world of the, what I call the barbarian king. The barbarian king is wreaking throughout the planet. And some of us have the ability to make a stand for grace and for this objective love that comes through. And those that can, those that are able, should. You're not going to be called on to become the oracle of Tibet, though. But you are called upon. And then there's a nice discussion about, you know, not a nice, but a strong discussion about what the actor does when they move into the space of the character. And when we assume the role of a macro-dimensional being, as small as we are able to inhabit, and I guarantee you that we are able to do that. We are able to do that if we have the ability to handle this crackling as you're talking about. We're able to do that. We can take and allow something to descend into us that can then look around and say, what's here that, oh, now I see. So we have the ability to do some of these things, but it requires us to exercise a certain kind of Bardo etiquette is what I call it. Jumping ahead to the paragraph that starts with...
Which wouldn't be very part of the etiquette, right? Jumping ahead.
Simon is talking. Yeah. Okay, so Simon is saying, I'm saying this for the recording as well, that we move subtly and slightly toward the assemblage point. Oh, we move our assemblage point. Got it. And in that movement of the assemblage point, we start to see and perceive things that we could not before. So, once again, it's just the same language. This assemblage point is, that's the root of our ability to sense the vibratory sensation that is being offered to us. So the more we can expand, the new expansion allows us to accept the new electrical shape, right? Yeah.
And
so they go back and forth. Our ability to accept the chi, the grace, the objective love, the more we're able to do that, the more we can see and see the categories and the land about us. And then I'm going to jump now into this beginning of the discussion of the shamanic voyager. And the paragraph that starts with, the shamanic voyager who is free of primate reflex passes, 87 in the new edition, who is free of primate reflex, passes eventually into a chamber which can be recognized by the following factors. This is what we were talking about earlier. A hushed stillness, a feeling of isolation and eternal timelessness, a feeling of completeness. The chamber needs nothing outside itself to sustain itself, complete. It's an hermetic seal through which no unauthorized visitors may pass. Every object and every inhabitant of the chamber has a place, a definite place. Everyone and everything belongs there, and what is not there does not belong there. And everything that is in that chamber is native to that chamber. Isn't that beautiful? Yes. And who's asking? Ben Hogg is saying, and where can I find out more about this idea of the barbarian king? So going back to that concept. I don't know exactly where I can point you to, but if you want to do a little bit of research, Ben Hogg, for all of us, and I haven't done this for a few decades actually, is to research in the Bible the phrase that powers and principalities. It shows up a very few time in the Bible, like less than a dozen, like half a dozen times, or maybe even only four or five. But the idea is that it's the powers and principalities of the macro dimension are what moves, moving the game board. And when the game board moves towards the human biological machine and just existence and survival, then the barbarian king is winning at that time. I'm saying it because my sensing is the barbarian king has made a move on the chessboard, has moved on the chessboard, and we have a chance to counter that to the extent that we are able, whatever we're able, one inch, one drop, take that then. Because it's part of the play between these powers and principalities. So the shamanic voyager, and then jumping ahead, a few paragraphs then, the study of chambers seems at first impossibly subtle, but then as familiarity allows, elaboration of vision and higher perceptive function. You know, we were just talking at dinner about this new game everybody's playing called Diablo 3. And people are saying, oh, it's not as friendly as the other one, it's not as nice and all of this. And I say, well, after you've played it about 5,000 times like you played Diablo 2, then it will, then as familiarity allows elaboration of vision, and higher perceptive functions kick in, then even exceedingly minor variations become obvious until only macro trivia enthusiasts perceive in the very deepest subtleties of the more rarefied atmospheres and so on. That's funny. That's very funny. At various points, the truly attentive voyager may notice the dim, shimmering presence residing far outside the ordinary visible spectrum, more felt than seen, of a vibratory doorway leading to another chamber. This is what we're talking about. Perfecting your sensing of the vibratory sensation within you as your compass. It's the map. It's a weird thing. It's just suddenly thinking of things in a different manner. We think of, oh yeah, you go down this street, you turn left, two blocks, you turn right, and then you're there. It's different than that, but the map is just as obvious in a certain way, isn't it? Just once you work with it a while, just you know. But I don't want to be mysterious here. Oh, well, you just know. You do know. Right now, you know to the extent that you do know, and that's the beginning, and that's where we are. Not that you know nothing, it's that you know the beginnings of it, right? And that's what we take. You take that. jumping ahead just a little bit, the key to this type of soft transition is intentionally self-produced relaxations at points of electromagnetic tension. Wait a minute, maybe I better read that again. We didn't get it. The key to this type of soft transition is intentionally self-produced relaxation. Where?
At points of electromagnetic tension.
Oh, I see. Has anybody ever experienced that? Macrodimensional or electromagnetic tensions? Sometimes it's so subtle and it's pressing on you so difficult with so much pressure, you just leave. You don't even know it was a tension. Suddenly you're just not there. You're having your double ice cream cone at Thrifty's and game over. Suddenly, oh, I'm not there anymore. Okay? So that's one that you need to write down. The intentionally self-produced relaxation at points of electromagnetic tension. This is the recipe right there in front of us. When you sniff that you're supposed to be in the space and you have this intense electromagnetic tension, that's a key. It's a key to a different form of self-remembering. It says, oh, I remember this dance. And at that moment, rather than get, you surrender to the space. You surrender to the space so that you can be there and allow the manifestation of that to come and flow through you. And you just read the next couple of paragraphs on your own. But then EJ goes into, we've already seen that both individual and clustered voyagers influence a labyrinth voyage according to individual typicality, a blend of attitude, cultural conditioning, and general emotional tone. So typicality of a voyager, like I've said all along, we all have a specific signature to how we dance in this particular field. And some have, everybody's very different, and by blending different typicalities, which takes a lot of difficulty. That's not the only thing. I don't want to say that's the only way to do anything, but it is the only way to do certain things. And I think I've spoken at some length about the Seamorg. Did I talk about that before?
Yeah, well, I think we
you
talked
remember
about
that.
It. Yeah.
In like the last book or
last
something.
Last book.
Mm-hmm. The Seamorg experience where there was enough macro-dimensional presence of the individuals there where in a certain way the Seamorg was supposed to be able to manifest. Because people were able to do what? Oh yeah, it's called self-produced relaxation at points of electromagnetic tension. They allowed it to come in, and they get their giant egos out of the way, massively giant egos, for 1 second, and then something can happen. And that's what happened that evening. Okay? I won't go into it in detail, but there apparently is a talk on it.
Totally rare space.
Called the
yeah,
Seamorg.
Yeah,
that's the talk of the month.
Talk of the month, yeah.
And so, you know, there are places and times when you can have orchestrated clusters of highly disciplined voyagers. So we'll talk about this idea of disciplined voyagers in the space and more as we go through the other chapters. But I know that in a month or so, I'm going to go be down in Southern California, but then I'll meet with a few people at that time. And I happen to know that if I'm with that Riverside group, that's a group of disciplined voyagers. Okay? And then with smaller subgroups of that, other things are possible. And we'll work with that as well. So I'm kind of jumping way ahead here. but that's okay. I'm going to jump ahead like two pages now to page 92 in the new edition. And it's a paragraph starting with, in the ordinary course of events.
That's on page 82 in the old edition.
Okay. 82 in the old edition, 92 in the new edition. In the ordinary course of events, we come into contact with many morphologies. But because we are composed of familiar morphological constructs, things should be like this. Isolated from the greater whole by our own perceptual occlusion, but not separated in fact. Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
If we can just allow, maybe it can be different. Maybe what we're seeing between ourselves and someone else could be different. Allow it to be. Stand out of the way for just a moment of your own perceptual occlusion. Just try it for a few minutes. You can practice that, by the way. Shamanism is not for the weak-hearted. What we're talking about is, it's not for the weak-hearted. It's not for those who wish to hold on to the occlusion, their own ego perceptual occlusion. If you're willing to break free of that, then there's a fluidity in these spaces. It's only when we push back. And then on page, the next page, and then EJ gives a nice list of certain people, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Rembrandt, who broke out of it. And certain actors, he likes Peter Sellers and so on, who broke out of these occlusions to become intuitional invocationists. It's a nice phrase. They were on their own, and they just could find and weave their way in a different manner. Nearly the entire organum of written material on shamanism was produced by outsiders. And Colin Wilson actually wrote a book called The Outsiders, and this is in the 60s. And there he details certain individuals, and he makes a note of Nijinsky, Van Gogh, Dostoevsky as being artist types. Van Gogh, if you look at his work, it's staggering. He was unknown during his lifetime. Unknown. Miles Davis would be another example. It just broke through into new areas altogether. And then a couple of pages ahead on 95 on this one, it's a paragraph starting with, attention is a powerful key, a potent invocational tool. Attention is a powerful key, a potent invocational tool. Because all macrodimensional voyaging is ultimately a function of attention. Note this well, which is to say the extension of presence into the total field of potential attention, a concept which has been boiled down many centuries ago into the phrase, the kingdom is already at hand. And this is what you were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
this presence,
mm-hmm.
and just allowing yourself to be in the presence.
So we have relaxation and attention.
Powerful tools. And we have our objects of invocation that we may bring. That helps us. And relaxing allows them to help us move through those spaces. And then we can apply the attention of the essential self and allow that to come forward. And that becomes a potent invocational tool. The kingdom is already at hand. Shaman learns to concentrate attention. Not the attention of the machine, but of the essential self, even the attention of a whole group in seance. Human primates are easily impressed with unusual phenomena. There will be, from the point of view of the human being, strange phenomena. Let it be. Who cares? That's not the point. That proves nothing. It's just something. It's just an attribute, a symptom, a blah, blah, blah. Then, jumping ahead, the applied use of concentrated attention, if we take our possible intensity of attention as something far beyond the ordinary level of attention, which has been for thousands of years sufficient in our society to qualify ourselves among the most intelligent species on the planet. It suggests a discipline of attention, so we can see that such a discipline lies far afield from our usual idea, what we ordinarily accept as the power of attention. So we're talking about a different type of attention. Once these doors are open, then we begin to apply this attention of the essential self. This opens a door between dimensional domains and is the most typical form of invocation. And that's at the end of, the parrot starts with some knowledge of the higher dimensional laws. And the last sentence is, this opens a door between dimensional domains and is the most typical form of invocation. In a sense, we hoist ourselves up by our own bootstraps, developing skills of attention towards self-invocation and placing ourselves somewhere where we are not. Our work attention is only as effective as the attention of the essential self. The special form of attention is a tool to which we will return again and again throughout our lives as voyagers in the labyrinth. Does this make sense then? Is this something that you can hold on to? That once you can get yourself into the space, and we've learned a couple of things on how to do that, this is the art and science of invocation. Take a science out of that invocation for yourself. Know that every time you have that amulet in your space and you can focus on it, suddenly it'll open that door to the invocational space upon which then you know, because you have the vibratory sensation, now is when I apply that level of attention.
David, I also wanted to say that that paragraph that starts with some knowledge of higher dimensional laws, we can construct a resonating chamber in our own dimension and activate it. That is the carry on of that first paragraph, the opening paragraph where we talked about resonating between chambers, and that paragraph specifically talks to that rather than our self relaxation and our attention, but that there are ways of activating the resonating, but we need a knowledge of higher dimensional laws,
and we begin to gather that for our own sense of those macro dimensional laws. Some of you are healers, I know that. And you do a certain form of healing, that, and you know how to begin to navigate in those spaces. That's what this is talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the knowledge, you have knowledge of how to operate in those spaces. That doesn't mean that you can write a book on it, or that you should write a book on it. It means that you know how to navigate. So, developing skills of attention towards self-invocation. Our work attention is only as effective as the attention of the essential self. The special form of attention is a tool to which we will turn again and again as lives of the voyagers in the labyrinth. So we're talking, we've left the human biological machine. Now we're talking about focusing only on the bardo voyaging, this voyaging in the labyrinth. We've left this planar world into a multiplanar world. And now we move through there, and these are the tools on how to do it.
I'd like to point out that first sentence is in italics, too. That is a really important sentence. our work attention is only as effective as the attention of the essential self. That gives us a clue as to our last book, that we really need to continue practicing on all of that as well.
So when you get into these spaces, and you might be in that space this evening, right now, if you're in that space right now, note it and say, this is what that special attention is like. This is that the attention of the essential self. Now, apply more of it. Now, when you apply more of that attention, it's not like, oh, I'm going to try a lot harder. It's actually the opposite of that. It's actually surrendering more to the space allows more of that attention to be at and available for us. And, you know, then there's a conversation about, you know, the limitations of the human primate and how we bring our primitive, really, occlusions to the game. That's what we're stuck in. Our job is to form discernment and not allow the human primate occlusions into those sacred spaces. They are sacred spaces that we find there. They are sacred because they are not spaces of the human world. They're not spaces that are created by the earth and the survival of the monkey man. They're spaces that are created by the absolute descending at those moments in however small we can host it at that moment, right?
Right.
Right. So it's whatever we can host
at
that
time. Good way of saying it. Whatever we can do to
help. If we can do 1 inch, then we can do 1 inch,
mm-hmm.
right? And the big boys can do a lot, but we can do something. And when we can do something, and you do that, then you've made a stand, Sinhog, against that barbarian king. Do what you can. You do what you're able to do, and do it as often as you can do it.
It helps us to relax into that rather than forcing our will, you know, our primate will onto the space.
Perfect. And you don't fight. Don't fight against the earth, but surrender to something even more.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the story of Brother Lawrence, the least of the monks, and he was given the lowest job, which is to wash the plates, it's all because he couldn't lead the singing, he couldn't lead the prayer. He had to wash the plates. He washed and washed and washed until it became a sacred act for him. And the beautiful phrase is this, and I saw God in the soap bubbles. Okay?
That is great.
Yeah.
That is
and
beautiful.
I saw, because he was praying each time he cleansed a plate for the next person. This prayer of invocation, which is allowing that to come down.
What attention he was using?
What he used his attention of his essential self.
Mm-hmm.
And as it says in the Way of the Pilgrim, it says it's in the Bible, but the Way of the Pilgrim makes a big deal out of this little phrase. Pray always. Pray always. How can you do that? Pray always. Well, you can. So where are we?
Praying always.
Ah, I see. People have put it into action. Are we getting close?
Well, we...
We're there?
I don't know. We're on the last page of chapter 9. How does everybody feel about that?
Are there any more questions, Molly?
I'm hoping that we'll get some great comments because I have been reading Wings of Chaos.
Half World acknowledges that God is in the soap bubbles. He uses prowl. What did Simon say? Okay. Do all that you can for the divine. Do all that you can to host the divine. He says what?
Pray without ceasing.
Pray without ceasing. Thessalonians. Yeah, and that's carry that, that's in the New Testament. Carry that along with you in your back pocket. It'll be like a hot coal. And pray always, it says. And you won't ever be able to let that one go. What's the quatrain that ends this chapter? You want to read that?
The quatrain that ends up.
The very last. No, wait.
Oh. There's a little quatrain at the end of this chapter.
What is it?
Let's read that. It says, you. You is. You is here. Hi, you.
Nice. So thank you for coming tonight. These are big baskets of fruit that we're holding, and I'm glad we're holding them together. So next week, what is chapter 10, by the way? Is there a chapter 10 in this book?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there
right
is.
Right in chapter 10. We've got data retrieval in the higher dimensions.
So that'll be next Wednesday, 7 o'clock, on your favorite channels. So see you then.
It might be me again next week. I'm not sure. Ivan might be back, or it might be me.
Well, that would be wonderful.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you.
Good night.